evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to yet another episode of Golden Dawn Radio. I'm your host, George, and here with me again, as always, is my comrade, Ed. How you doing tonight, Ed?
I'm doing well, George. Good to be back on the air.
Yeah, it's very good to be back. And, boy, I would say you probably agree with me, Ed, that of all our episodes, I would say this is the most prolific one in terms of what we're going to be talking about. We're going to have first a recap of the series of events that have happened since the elections. As many of you know, in the end of January, Greece went through its snap elections, and Syriza was elected the new party. And a lot of interesting acrobatics, for lack of a better term, have taken place. And we'll take you through those step by step. The next thing we're going to be talking about is, within these acrobatics, the Minister of Finance, Yanis Varoufakis, who is probably one of the best acrobats of the series of team. He's a very interesting character. One of the most talented, let's say. Then we're going to be talking about the descent into disillusionment that has occurred in light of these acrobatics and the switching of Syriza's policies from being very anti-austerity, you know, changing the system and all of these kind of myths and fairy tales into a basically another social democratic party, as was with the previous one, which was called PASOK in the early 80s. Then we're going to get into talking a bit about Golden Dawn's plan for getting out of this crisis. This is something, of course, we have said in the past, but it rings even more true now, especially in light of what's happened. So, and finally, with that, we're going to talk a bit about the upcoming releases of our comrades and our leader, Nikos Mihaliakos, Christos Papas, and Yanis Lagos. Now, these three are going to be the first to be released because they were the first to go in, and we'll talk a bit about that and what that might entail, and then the upcoming trial that they're claiming to, that will take place now, finally. So, first we're going to talk a bit, in case some of you listeners haven't heard, about the election results. Golden Dawn finished, as we had been predicting, the third political force in the country. It got just under 6.5%. Syriza got the first percentage, the first amount, and New Democracy, which was the previous ruling party, came in second after a very, very steep decline. So the highest percentage went to Syriza. New Democracy lost, I think, about almost half of its strength, if I'm not mistaken. Golden Dawn third, and then another party behind Golden Dawn, which was the, they're called Topotami, which means the river in Greek, and they were trailing in fourth, just behind Golden Dawn, which was a kind of a media party that was created on the television channels in Greece.
Yep.
Now, Ed, you want to take people through a little bit of the, let's say, some of the things that were going on during the elections. Like, for example, you want to talk a little bit about the ballot tampering.
Well, let me start off with the fact that the campaigning was not fair. For example, Parliament member Mathiopoulos, when, for example, in Greece, they allot a certain time period on the television, on public, on state-run television, for all the different parties to give their platform. Aside from the fact that the Golden Dawn leadership was all in jail and not even giving given a conditional release to campaign and compete as equals for this election, they had Mathiopoulos in charge of things, and every other party was getting prime time on television, 5 o'clock, 6 p.m., 7 p.m., but they gave Golden Dawn one time slot at 3 in the morning.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, is that really, who's going to watch that? That's on purpose. You know, it's just, that's the whole joke of this democratic system, is that it's all semantical. If you don't play by their corrupt rules, you get put in the 3 a.m. time slot, you know. And besides that, then we go into the election. We have, in different polling stations, we have anarchists and communists standing by with the police watching them, intimidating people as they're walking into the ballot. They're telling them, you better not vote for Golden Dawn because I'm going to kick the crap out of you, you know, things like that. The myriad of cheating that went on during this election simply to undermine Golden Dawn is unprecedented in Greek history. And I think the fact that they still, despite all of the challenges, got 7% and came in third place says a lot. It says a lot about how popular the support for the group is and how dedicated activists, voters, and organizers on the grassroots level and at the top, how dedicated they are to this cause, you know.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I want to say is that what happened in the last elections was a very, I would say, a desperate move on the part of the Greek people. A good reason, a major reason why Syriza was elected the first party was because people were really saying, okay, we have to do something to get Samaras out. And because of the media thing, like you said, with the blocking of Golden Dawn as a solution, they were presenting Syriza as the only solution to these problems. And people were so sick and tired of Samaras that they voted for Syriza in the hopes that, okay, he's going to do something. Now, from what my comrades have told me over there, that there's a general, and rightfully so, there's a general distrust in Greece of political parties as a whole. So what I've been told is that most people, and I, you know, from living over there, I believe this myself, they didn't really believe that Syriza was going to do everything they said, but they thought, okay, if they can do something, maybe get us a better deal or what have you, then at least it's something, anything but this Samaras Venizelos thing that keeps bleeding us dry. So out of desperation, they voted for Syriza. Now, Golden Dawn scored in the election, it was about just under 6.5%. Now, likely, it's hard to estimate, but it's likely they were somewhere around 7 to 7.5. I believe that there was some voters that might have went to Syriza just to see, like, it's the kind of thing where people see, oh, well, I don't think Golden Dawn's going to win, or I don't think this other smaller party is going to win, so I'm going to vote for the next biggest party just to do something, which is a common thing in elections everywhere, in all these democracies everywhere. You've heard that phrase in the United States quite often, you know, like when someone wants to vote for a third party other than the Democrats or the Republicans, they say, oh, well, you're just wasting your vote. You know, vote for the lesser of two evils or something like that. And that's, sort of less extreme, of course, than the United States, but that does happen in Europe. Now, what I wanted to go into, Ed, to explain to some people...
Not to interrupt you, but, I mean, we even saw people in the nationalist scene were saying to vote for Syriza, so it's not just the average Greek's problem.
Oh, absolutely.
It's an ideological problem. You had Marine Le Pen telling Greeks to vote for Syriza. Now, I don't really consider her an authentic nationalist personally, but she was literally endorsing a cultural Marxist hardcore pro-immigration party.
Right.
Probably because her handlers told her to. So it's not just the average. So just imagine what the average Greek that's going in as a blank slate, looking at all the options, he sees Syriza and he's like, if I vote for Golden Dawn, it's going to be a waste of my vote.
Right.
But even then, there's still that hardcore that a lot of Zionist media was talking about, after the election,
right,
that 7%, that consistent 7% that voted for Golden Dawn, that's never going away. You're going to have to deal with them forever.
That's right, yeah. That's right. and you know, that's, it's past the point now where they can explain their way out of it like they used to. You know, in the past, they were like, oh, the people are just confused. They don't really know what Golden Dawn is.
Not anymore.
Yeah, they don't say that anymore. In fact, now, they those same journalists and communists on TV, they say to the people, like, oh, how could, you know, basically they're saying these voters are evil, you know, and they have no excuse anymore.
No, they just say outright.
Shame on them.
7% you know? Of the Greek population are Nazis. That's what they say.
Shame on them, you know.
It's ridiculous, but I mean...
Now, back to the ballot tampering. What cost, or what, let's say, eroded some of Golden Dawn's votes was the first thing. Some of the polling stations in Athens, there was the ones that I had just heard about, and I'm sure there was more of those, but I remember two in some Athenian suburbs where anarchists, again, physically attacked people and voters at the polling stations, causing sort of a riot. There was some violence that happened. Police intervened. Some elderly people got injured. And I'm not just talking about people who were voting for Golden Dawn. I mean just people who were caught in the commotion getting injured. That's one thing. The other thing is that in the Greek elections, the way it works is that they have these polling stations all over the place. Usually they're in schools, and like for example, they'll have a school with different classrooms, and these people are given, it's not like a computer system or anything like that, they're given like a booklet, not a booklet, but they can pick out different ballots and then they can put it in the box, basically. Mm-hmm. They're given a choice of these slips, let's say, and each slip has a, you know, different party's platform and logo on it. And when they split it up in these classrooms, they are supposed to have someone there from each party to watch and make sure that those ballots, those slips of paper are you know, properly stocked for one thing, that nobody's gonna mess around with the other one. Now, in the past, this was never an issue because none of these other degenerate, you know, systematic parties ever threw away each other's votes or anything because it was just a game to them, you know, and they didn't really care. They would sit there, they would talk to each other, and, you know, nobody would really do that. But now that Golden Dawn's in the mix, in some areas where Golden Dawn did not have enough people to patrol every single polling classroom, let's say. Usually, now this didn't happen so much in Athens, but it happened in a lot of villages, for example. A lot of areas where they have a village or a smaller, medium-sized village on the outskirts of a city, a smaller city, where there's not as many Golden Dawners, and they can't get enough people to watch every single classroom. There was cases, and I've heard this firsthand from people who were there watching, of them throwing away ballots in some classrooms, so there was not even an option to get the Golden Dawn ballot. Women from PASOK and New Democracy and some communist series of parties were the women who were paid to watch for Syriza or whatever, they would scrape with their fingernail, they would damage the ballot. So if that ballot was even put in, it's not counted. A mutilated ballot is not allowed to be counted, according to the Greek procedure on this. So that happened as well. So these things combined, of course, with the media blackout and all that, it counted for some, let's say, some loss or leakage of Golden Dawn votes. But this time, they were better prepared than last time, but, you know, it's just, at this point, it's inevitable with the amount of corruption and the way that things go in Greece, which they call a banania, you know, a banana republic. It's the way that democracy works over there right now.
You got to look at also the odds that they pretty much superseded, which are, for example, having your entire leadership in prison and still conducting a campaign is safe to say a little difficult.
It's never been done before, actually. I don't think anywhere. I mean, I don't even think in Africa or Senegal or Asia that this has ever happened.
No, they're transparent. They just say, okay, your party can't run anymore.
Exactly.
And but in the hypocritical European Union, it's all about semantics. Oh, so what if we put you in prison for your political beliefs? You can still run. You can conduct your campaign by making paper floaties and throwing it through the bars.
Yeah, but to be actually, even in the rest of Europe, that's not the case. Because, like, for example, in France, they banned every nationalistic party except for the so-called nationalist party Front National right now.
Right.
So that's a little suspicious right there, you know.
Well, yeah, of course. They use any little act, no matter how isolated, as an excuse to crack down. I mean, at least Idi Amin would just pull you away in the night, put you in prison, and then you'll never be heard of again. But in Europe, they actually pretend that when they violate their supposed own constitutions and own human rights clauses, they claim they're doing it for human rights.
Yeah, and not only just the jailing, but they cut off the funding which is constitutionally allotted to Golden Dawn. Because the way the Greek law works is that a political party that gets a certain amount of votes is entitled to a certain amount of state money in correlation to the amount of votes that they get. All the other parties have been taking this for years, and they all voted just to cut that off from Golden Dawn.
But how about the fact that, you know, if you're going to imprison Golden Dawn for some guy stabbing some other guy for non-political reasons, why didn't they actually ban groups like Antarcia or put anyone in prison at all? All these groups like Antarcia that have close relations with the Marxist underworld that was responsible for killing two innocent young men in November 2013 that were part of Golden Dawn. There hasn't been a single arrest in that case. So this is the doublethink of their so-called human rights and freedom. It's an abstraction, and it's based on semantics. It's not a real tangible thing, because if it was, if they actually did protect the constitutional rights of Golden Dawn, they would be in power by now. And that's why they don't do it, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly why. And, it's disgusting. You know, another thing, I wanted to go over, now we got to jump right into this, because this is a big thing. The electoral victory of Syriza. Now, let's start with the first day, the first 24 hours. We'll get into that, then we'll get into the 48 hours. So Syriza gets elected. Leftists everywhere are celebrating. They're screaming at the top of their lungs. They're singing songs. The leftists in other European countries, in Italy, in Spain, in everywhere, they're just cheering. It's a new day for Europe. I'm sitting and watching the satellite TV, you know, what's going on in Greece, and they're just showing this, I don't know, a circus. That's the way I could describe it. It was a circus, a media circus.
The same everywhere. In the junk media, mass media, everything from the New York Times to Al Jazeera, everyone was, they were treating Tsipras like he was the second coming of Christ.
Yeah.
Or even more important than Jesus, like he was Saint Martin Luther King. They were treating him like he was this Messiah that was going to deliver everything, and they really made a mistake by doing that, because now they look very, very silly, you know, at this point.
So then, so that was, like, I would say the first 12 hours, let's say. Then after that, once they, it was deliberated for about 3 hours who they were going to form a coalition with, and that turned out to be the party known as ANEL, or Independent Greeks. Now, ANEL is what is known in Greece as what used to be known as the far right. Not the extreme right, but the far right, conservative. This was started by Kamenos, the party leader who broke off from New Democracy. He started putting a lot of rhetoric up about, bankers and I guess you could say if people are familiar maybe more with UKIP in the United Kingdom.
Farage.
Nigel Farage, something like this. Now, this was tried before years ago with another party known as Laos in Greece. That party failed because it lost a lot of people who ended up going to Golden Dawn. So, ANEL was formed simply to take votes from Golden Dawn. It was its only purpose for existing. Now,
it was founded actually. To prove that, it was founded only a few months before the 2012 elections.
That's right.
When the polls started registering that Golden Dawn was going to enter Parliament. So, right. I mean, that's not a coincidence. The rhetoric that they use was somewhat similar to Golden Dawn, but obviously incomplete, because ANEL is pro-Zionist, refused to name the problems, and on top of that, they're a pro-capitalist party. They support laissez-faire capitalism.
Again, it was a thing where he was copying, sometimes word for word, Golden Dawn's policies and positions. He was going on television talking about international banking conspiracies. He was talking about things that were, what we've said all along is a Zionist type of plot, but the thing is that he left that part out, but he was saying that he had noticed all of these Masonic conspiracies and he was going to put an end to it and all this kind of stuff. But anybody who really looks at Greek politics for any length of time knows that this guy, he was in New Democracy for years. So if he was seeing all these conspiracies and he's such a patriot, how come he didn't jump out of New Democracy back then? Nobody has an answer for that. If you noticed all of these horrible conspiracies happening and the rape of Greece and all this, and you were staying in New Democracy eating, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But it's a certain portion of the population that believes in the propaganda against Golden Dawn.
Well,
but agree with the leftism. So they go with ANEL.
The whole coalition was actually probably founded about 8 months ago when Syriza and ANEL met with the American Jewish Committee, Harris, or the representatives of Harris. They met together, and Harris and Harris's group wrote that they were very enthusiastic supporters of Zionism and that they were content with all the parties in Greece, except for one, of course. So that whole coalition stuff, that was probably done a long time ago.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's my point, because some of the journalists were commenting. They said, wow, we thought that it would take Syriza and ANEL a long time to deliberate and form a coalition. Like, they thought it might take, 24 hours or 2 days to hammer out all the differences of the party platform and everything between the two. And that didn't happen. It took I think it was even less than 3 hours, if I'm not mistaken. It was really quick. So that, I remember they had commented on it. Now, what you had just said is a very good thing and a very key point, because that, I remember you saw it, Ed, listed on the American Jewish Congress's website, not on the headlines, not on the front page, but
tucked away for
tucked
Jewish
away.
Eyes only.
Right, right. So
not
this was
Greek
something
guys.
That the Greek people didn't even have any clue of, and in fact, many people in Golden Dawn didn't know about this. We were the first to actually notice this over here, because we keep eyes on this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. And and there you go. So now here's where it starts to get interesting. So that was about 12 afters after they really formed the government, and then all the leftists got a little spooked with that. So there was a British journalist that went, I watched this, it was pretty entertaining. She was with, I think, BBC, and she went and she started interviewing the Greeks that had voted for Syriza after that, the next day. And they were all saying how they were a little nervous, you know, I don't know, why are they making a coalition with this right-wing party? So a lot of the purists, let's say, the pure leftists were very upset with this. But, you know, they didn't want to admit they were wrong, they had their ego, so they're like, okay, let's wait and see. So when you get to be, what was it, about 48 hours, when you reach the 48-hour mark, then they started pushing the finance minister into the media a lot more and more. Varoufakis, his name is. Now, Varoufakis is a very interesting character. He was born in Greece, educated in England, so he speaks with this, like, fancy, you know, fake British lord type of thing.
You know, speaking with a British accent increases your IQ by 15 points.
Yeah, well, it definitely, that was the whole idea, you know, to make it sound like he knows what he's talking about. And he also has Australian citizenship. He lived in Australia for a while. And he came back to Greece, you know, and Syriza, you know, elected him. And so he was going to the BBC. He was going to all of these, you know, big media outlets. And he's giving these very, you know, in-depth speeches and sermons about, the debt is unsustainable. And, you know, what we are trying to do is we are going to, go and talk to our European partners and blah, 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 and all this kind of crap. And what was interesting is that some of the journalists, especially BBC, they were, like, very critical of him, like you know you're lying about that, basically. They were telling him, and he was just going on and, like, trying to get out of it. And then he called them rude. I remember he called one journalist
oh,
rude.
Oh, boy. Man, that's, like, then, the least Greek thing ever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's like, he told the lady, he
being
goes,
rude.
I must say, I normally respect the BBC, but you are being very rude, you know. Asking, because she was basically asking him, are you gonna take the bailout or not? You know,
yeah,
are you
asking
sign
him
the
a straight
memorandum
question.
Or not? Which is it? And he was just like, and I remember this one scene where he actually started stuttering, you know.
Oh boy.
He started stuttering like Rain Man, you know. But then he got a little pissed off, and then it just ended. But anyway, my point is that now while this was happening in Greece, the media was taking a different tune, where the media was making him out to be this hero, and then they were talking about how evil that British woman on the BBC was, and how mean, and how, you know, what a vile woman she was for questioning Varoufakis, and then they were talking about how Varoufakis likes to play video games, Varoufakis
My
rides
God.
A motorcycle, Varoufakis wears a leather jacket, Varoufakis and Tsipras, they don't wear a tie.
Well, that's what mass man politics are. I mean, they do the same thing with Pope Francis, with all these other media-created celebrities that, when it boils down to it, they're pretty worthless human beings and liars, and they're hurting their own people more than anything. But that's what they do, man. They make it into a personal thing, so people look at Varoufakis. You know, granted, he is a charming guy, and he is a pretty... He's good at BSing, you know. So
yeah.
So that the whole agenda with that is maybe so people will see him on TV and be like, you know, he might be lying about that whole memorandum thing, but I like him. I really like him.
Exactly.
Seems like a good guy to have a beer with.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was even seeing, like, on Facebook, there was, like, English women who were, like, saying, "Oh, I'd like to go out for a drink with Mr. Varoufakis.
Oh,
he seems like a nice lad." I mean, this guy was like we call it in Greek a kamaki. You know, like they call it I guess you could call him like he's like a 50-year-old cabana boy. This guy walking around Europe, you know, trying to act like he's a sex symbol and
playboy.
Just utter ridiculousness. I mean, really. But then again, I mean, I could see how they could use this angle at that moment for a very short period because, you know, in Europe, you got all these other politicians in Belgium and whatnot. They're like these nerdy guys with glasses, these accountant types. And then they got this guy. He comes in. He's like, "Oh, I'm wearing a leather jacket.
Yeah.
I ride a motorcycle." You know, I'm, you know, It's a typical, you know, Southern European type of angle that they were taking to present it. Like they were going to make it like this guy was going to just walk into the, you know, to the European, you know, bank meetings and things like this, and manage to, you know, get them to open up their wallet and give Greece a whole bunch more money.
Yeah, and he was also acting like he was going to blow them off, like James Dean or something, you know. Well, give me what I want, let's blow this joint.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but
exactly.
At the end of the day, what happened, George?
Yeah, well...
Go ahead.
Yeah. Wow, I mean, sometimes I can't even believe this story myself. I mean, I can believe it, but it's still like, when you think about it, it's pretty... It's amazing the speed at which it happened. That's what shocked me. So... Anyway, he goes and sees Schäuble, the German, and he's in charge of Germany's purse strings, let's say. And Schäuble basically tells him, "Look, let's cut the BS. We have all the money. You don't have any money, and you're going to beg us for money." And you know you're going to stay in the European Union. That's what you're going to do, and that's going to be the end of it. We're not going to agree to any of your whatever you're trying to say to the media or whatever. You know it, and I know it. Let's just cut the BS. And basically, Varoufakis started changing his tune after that. He started to say that they came to an agreement. The agreement was that. They're going to change the name of the memorandum. They're going to call it, how do we convert this into English? Okay, well, in Greece they had the term the Troika, which was the three, you know, representatives, the European Central Bank, the IMF, and the, you know, the Eurozone. They were basically going to, they had the term the Troika. So the Greeks were really pissed off about the term the Troika. So they called them the... institutional partners. So the Troika became institutional partners. The memorandum became the loan agreement.
Whoa.
Okay. Wow. Then there was talk about, what was it, the changes in the tax system. Like, in other words, basically Schäuble told him, yeah, you can change anything you want as long as we get that same amount of money every month or every, you know, quarter or whatever you are. So he's like, you know, he said, look, you can cut money from one thing and put it into another thing. You know, in other words, you could raise the sales tax and or lower the sales tax, let's say, so people think they're getting a break, and then you could raise property tax. I don't care. As long as you have my money... every quarter, whatever the, you know, whatever they agreed upon, I don't care what you do. So that was their compromise. Like, oh, sure, yeah, you can make a deal with us, you know?
You know, George, we used to compare a series a lot to PASOK, but, you know, PASOK actually ran in the 1980s. I believe it was 1981 they took power. Their platform was far more radical than Syriza's. PASOK's platform... was talking about leaving the European community, which was European Economic Community, which was the equivalent in the 80s of the European Union. They're talking about taking a stand against NATO. They're talking about a completely planned economy.
Yeah.
Talking about all this stuff, and it took them 2 years to back off from that and become another corrupt mm-hmm. you know, capitalist party. But Syriza actually... That's one thing they did better than PASOK. They actually reverted on all their promises within about a month, month and a half. So that's a new record, George. I think that's a new record in Greek politics. They're going to go down the history books for that, for betraying all their promises in the record time. There you go.
Yeah, I mean it's unprecedented. I don't think any party has done that quickly. I mean, it was literally within less than a week that it happened.
Yeah, and you know what? And all of the people that are supposedly on our side that were endorsing Syriza, look at the results. Look at what you got for that. This is just another systematic party. There is no left and right. There's only system and anti-system. Every other party is with the system, as we've been pointing out for years now with Syriza. And the only party that isn't completely controlled by the system is Golden Dawn.
Yeah.
The only party that has a solution for the memorandum, I mean, really, Varoufakis hasn't just agreed to the memorandum. You know, George, he actually has talked about now, he's promised to make Greece a better business climate. In other words, he's going to make it even more friendly to these French and German and Israeli corporations to exploit the Greek people and give nothing back, you know, because that's not the solution to the problems. The problems are supposed to be national solutions, not depending on neoliberalism, which Syriza is always talking against, to actually rescue you from this. There's no way out. There's no way out. They have to leave the European Union.
Yeah, like they were saying that they were going to stop the privatization of the ports in Piraeus, which is like the big port city in Greece. They didn't do it. They backed out on that almost immediately.
Well, how about the fact that they appointed the Lazard Bank, which is literally a New York Jewish bank, to restructure the public debt? That is beyond anything I expected of them. I thought they were going to just keep going with the European Union and all that. I didn't know they were going to copy everything PASOK did, policy per policy. Lazard Bank was in charge as a consultant for restructuring the Greek debt for a haircut in 2012. And what happened was that, guess what Lazard's solution was? It was to something that I believe Greece is the only country in the world where they've done this. In exchange for a haircut, they did something called the PSI, which is the Private Sector Initiative. And what happened was that from one day to another, the Greek government devalued bonds, national bonds, by 70%, right? But here's the kicker. The bankers, all the Goldman Sachs and all the Jewish bankers from around the world that owned Greek bonds, they got word months before, and they dumped the bonds, dumped them. And so when they came to that agreement from one day to another, the people that got hurt with the 70% devaluation of bonds were pensioners, were working people, you know, little people got hurt. People that had their life savings in bonds, because guess what? The Greek bank invested everything in the bonds. So a lot of people lost everything that day. And the government was saying that, oh, you just have to take this hit and the economy will be fine. They'll give us a haircut. We'll pay back the loan. And mind you, this was 3 years ago. Is the economy fine? No, it's only gotten worse. And on top of that, everyone lost their life savings and everything. Right on top, after they devalued the bonds, Goldman Sachs rebought all the bonds. Same with Lazard Brothers, because guess who Lazard, the Lazard Banking Company is going to support, and whose interests they're fighting for? Oh, they're bankers. And so all these bankers made so much money because they dumped their bonds and then bought them again for 30% of their value, and then when they got revaluated back to 100% of their value, they sold them again. They shorted the bonds. And so they made a killing that day at the expense of the Greek people. This is what I mean. People are blaming average Greeks for the economic crisis. The truth of the matter is that it's a bunch of Jewish bankers that are destroying Greece's economy. That's the fact. It might be politically incorrect, but it's bankers from New York, from Brussels, from France, from Germany. These are the people that are making sure that the economy does not take off again. They're profiting off the misery of the people, and every bailout they give them goes right to their banks. So it's not like it's being invested in infrastructure or creating jobs.
Well, I've said this many times, and that what we're seeing now is the later stages of this predatory process. This process started back when the first, you know, Social Democratic Party took over in 1981, which was PASOK. PASOK was, like you said, back then coming off as this revolutionary force and everything like that. But while they were doing this, they were taking loans, massive amounts of loans. Now, at this point, these loans were given for them to build up an army of voters through building up a false middle class, at the same time shutting down anything that would make the country self-sufficient. In that decade of the 1980s, the private sector shrunk completely and the public sector swelled. And the purpose of that and the reason why they were getting all this cheap credit was for exactly that reason. It was to soften up the country for the final onslaught, which is what we're seeing, you know, 30 years later. And that's what a lot of people don't really understand in Greece, because, you know, a lot of these people in Greece that had been very poor prior to the early 1980s had this surge of money coming into the country without asking really where it's coming from and where these jobs are coming from, and not really questioning why all the factories started to shut down and why the production started to cease. And many people didn't really question it because there was a lot of public sector type of work taking the place of these things, and with better pay and with better wages and everything. I mean, like we said on the last episode, you know, they were literally passing out campaign posters saying with a picture of a wallet on it saying vote for an even greater income to get more money in your wallet. So it doesn't get any more base than that, but they took advantage of the Greek people based on their willingness and their hope to better themselves, you know. And they managed to do this for a very long time. And now what's happening is that the country has been softened up. It has no production. Not only has no production, it's in so much. Now they've taken loans just to keep the country running. See, in the past they were taking loans to build up this private, public sector. They were taking all those loans to build this loyalty to those two parties and get everybody brainwashed in their little social democracy. But now it's the opposite. Now they're just telling them, look, if you don't want your if you don't want your pensions just to outright stop, and if you don't want to be kicked out of the Eurozone, you're going to do whatever we say now. So now it's the opposite. Now they're just begging for crumbs, you know.
Well, you know, it came out under Papandreou that during his tenure, Goldman Sachs was actually cooking the books. In other words, they were making the Greek economy look like it wasn't as bad as it was, in order to keep lending the money at exorbitant interest rates. So, in truth, Greeks weren't even aware that their economy was actually a basket case until maybe when, 2008, 2009, when all these revelations started coming out?
There were some Greeks that were aware, but they were like Greeks who were economists, Greeks who had studied abroad. There was a Greek who lived in Germany, in fact, a very educated man. His name escapes me right now. He was a Greek, German economist, spoke fluent German, wrote all kinds of books about economy, not just Greek economy stuff, but he was very highly respected within Germany. He wrote a book in the 90s, okay, when everything was seemed like it was on the up and up about this issue. And none of the Greeks really listened to him. In fact, the Greek media back then was mocking him and making fun of this man. You know, they were making him like he was some kind of, you know, nutty professor type, you know. And he basically said in a nutshell that, look, this is unsustainable. It's going to collapse very soon. It's going to collapse, and they're going to run out of money, and then they're going to come for everything, and that's going to be it. And they were just saying, oh, like, what are you talking about? You're talking nonsense. And sure enough, this is what happened. So, but you have to think of it this way. Most people who've come from smaller towns or villages, and this is true anywhere, whether it be Greece or anywhere else, the average, person who lives in a rural community or a small town, they don't really have any concept of these kind of shifty credit default swaps or a pump and dump scheme. I mean, if I go to the middle of Alabama and I start talking to a guy like me from New York going down to Alabama and talking to guys about pump and dump schemes with stock fraud, they're not really going to listen to me. They don't know what I'm talking about. It's like I'm speaking Chinese to them. The same is true in Greece, where you have, some really educated Greeks that have been around. They understand what's happening. And they try to talk to the common people, and it's not really in people's nature like that to understand. It's anywhere.
Well, I think that us as living in an urban environment with lots of you-know-whos, we're kind of on our defensive, where we understand that everything and anything that someone tells us could be a lie. If you come from a small town, and you're more innocent-minded, and you're trusting, then you're more prone to believe someone when they say, oh, things are going great, we're doing this, we're doing that, and so that's something people need to start developing, that kind of skepticism, even cynicism. Because in the world how it is today, everything, there are so many parasites and predators out there looking to deceive you, that you really need to be on your guard all the time. And so if someone tells you something, even in America, like they say the unemployment is 6%, but it's actually closer probably, they say, to 15 or more. So everything that you hear from the media, everything you hear from your politicians, everything you hear even at school is a lie, a lot of it. So this is something people now are starting to develop in places like Greece, in the small towns, in the villages, everything. People are now starting to realize, now with Syriza especially, after they told a whopper of a lie, that they just can't trust any politician. And that's going to benefit Golden Dawn, because the only politicians in the entire Greek nation that have not lied to the people once is Golden Dawn. And even the Jewish leftist professor Noam Chomsky has recently stated, he said that the fact that Syriza has lied so brazenly to the Greek people means that Golden Dawn is most likely going to take power now. So, and he's a very, for whatever, he's a leftist and Jewish, but he's a very astute and intelligent man, and he knows what he's talking about. I've read some of his stuff, and he's actually not that bad, but he's saying it. So, and everyone else is starting to say it now, too. Yeah. So be prepared.
Yeah, I mean, this is, for all you nationalist-minded people out there, whether you're Greek or American or, European, basically the purpose of social nationalism, which is Golden Dawn's ideology, and there are many similar ideologies in Europe right now, it's basically, for lack of a better word, it's like a human body where you're trying to teach your body to develop antibodies to a disease. What we offer as a ideology and what we believe is something that makes people look at the, not just vote differently based on a set of issues, like what is your position on issue A or issue B or issue C, which is what all political parties have tended to do in the last 50 years, 60 years. This is a worldview, so it's based off of seeing what is happening to us as a people, as a race, as a nation, and how do we defend ourselves. So when things like this start happening with economy or with cultural attacks or whatever it may be, we're trying to teach people how to not just simply to oppose it by voting, but to learn the kind of tricks that our enemies are using to destroy us, to learn the kind of mentality of who we're dealing with and the little games that they play, so that when you turn on the television and you see these people talking to you, you no longer trust them, which is something that slowly this is happening in Europe, but it's still a long way to go, particularly in countries that have had less, let's say, turmoil than Greece has right now, you know, like in Sweden, in the Netherlands, in some of these countries that are just starting now to really feel the sting of things like, you know, immigration and Islamic terror and things like this. This is something that's going to, more and more as time goes on, people are going to develop these antibodies, and that's when we are going to take control of our respective nations again. And we're not going to be pushed around anymore.
The way people have to see it is that the people in power, they study psychology, they study propaganda, they study sociology, all these things that help you understand the minds of people, you know. And so they develop formulas to keep them under control through this knowledge. I mean, everything from when you listen to radio, that you know, that slow talking you hear on BBC, that kind of stuff, that's all done on purpose, because it's called neuro-linguistic programming. It's all done to enter your mind and never come out. And so
and facial expressions too.
Facial expressions. This is all trained. It's scripted. And this is, and you know what? And when you tell someone this for the first time, they might think you're crazy. But the reality of the matter is that this is happening. This is happening, and this is how they keep us under control. And on top of that, do not underestimate how cynical and insidious they are. Some of them might even come out and say they're anti-immigration, like some of these new parties coming out that are based on the whole Muslim thing. You know, oh, Islam, they don't like gays and Jews or something. Yeah, okay, but that doesn't mean that they're anti-immigration. It just means that they have a problem with it ideologically, but not ethnically or racially.
Right. So, well, that's what I'm saying. That's the difference between having a position on an issue, like I said, like issue A or issue B, and having a worldview.
Yeah.
Because if you have a worldview and a way of thinking and a way of reacting in these antibodies, you can see through what they're saying beyond just what they're saying about that issue. Because on the surface, okay, they're anti-immigration, they're anti-Islamic, for example. This is a big one. In Europe, they say, we have to stop these Muslims, we have to stop Sharia law, we have to stop, the Islamic terrorism, we have to stop all of these kinds of horrible things as a result of crime by Muslim immigrants. But now, on the surface, when someone looks at that, this is the position of pretty much every nationalist party. But what's the difference? The difference is, how are they going to deal with this problem? When you look a little closer at how they intend to deal with this problem, take, for example, Golden Dawn. Golden Dawn says, okay, yeah, this is a problem. Now, to the Greeks, the problem of Islamic crime and atrocities, this is like... And forgive my language for this, it's like saying a bear shits in the woods, you know. We already know this. This has been going on for 400 years. It's not like in Sweden where it just started happening, 30, 40 years ago. Not even in some cases. Mm-hmm. So while some countries are at the stage right now where they're like, oh my God, I can't believe these people are behaving this way. I can't believe they're doing this. Why are they doing this? And they're confused because it's not something a Swedish person would do. You know, they can't even imagine that there's people that exist that do stuff like that. So they get shocked from it. But what happens is that these political parties that are not like Golden Dawn, they say, okay, this Islamic threat is here and we have to do something about it. The two things that they say is that, one, we have to limit the immigration, not reverse the immigration, but limit it. and we have to screen immigrants, you know, show them a video of two gays kissing or a...
Like in Holland, yeah.
A woman running on the beach in a bikini. And if the guy freaks out and starts, you know, screaming Allahu Akbar, then we're not going to let him in the country anymore. Okay. Now, what is the purpose of this? The purpose is that they're not, their issue isn't with Muslim immigration so much as for a racial or a cultural thing. Their issue is to protect their current state, their
liberalism.
Social democracy, their liberalism. So their reason for being against this Islamic problem is different than the reason that Golden Dawn has. Even though on the surface, this might seem like exactly the same thing. They're both anti-immigration, anti-Muslim, whatever. But Golden Dawn says, no, we want to control our borders, and we want every single Islamic immigrant, and whether they're Islamic or not, we don't want foreigners here. Greece
right.
belongs to the Greeks. And that's it. End of story.
That nuance is extremely important because some people might dismiss it as, oh, that's just a small difference. No, it's not, because if tomorrow you gave those... Think of it this way, right? You're a Pakistani, right? And very devout in your religion. Now, what would... If you were devout... I'm sorry. If you were devout in your religion, what would possess you to want to move to Europe? If you really are a true blue Muslim. I mean, Europe is the home of homosexuality, of feminism, of all the worst. Jews control it. Why would you, as a Muslim, want to go there? Now, some idiots want to pretend that it's because some 75 IQ Pakistani is behind an elaborate plot to establish Sharia law in Europe. The reality of the matter is that they're going there to eat our food, to sleep with our women, to live off our welfare, to take our jobs. This is why they're in Europe. So if you take the whole Islamic thing from an ideological perspective, like, oh, Islam is not compatible with liberalism, you lose. Because when you do that, if you gave those people that are living in Europe now, that are from Asia and Africa, if you gave them the choice between not going to their mosque and leaving, they're going to choose not going to their mosque, and they're just going to keep living in your country, and they're going to keep committing crimes, they're going to keep killing you, they're going to keep taking your jobs, and that goes for the people that aren't Muslims too. So, you know, it would be like, to make a parallel, it would be like pretending all the Mexicans in America would go home if you just shut down all the Catholic churches and make Catholicism illegal, you know. It's the same. It's the same logic.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Just not true. It's not. Most of the Muslims in Europe are fairly secular, and they like living there, in the sense of the material benefits of living there. So you're not going to get them out like that. You're going to have to be openly anti-immigration and get them out, because guess what? If you're not an indigenous person of this continent, go home. There's no space for you. That has to be the mentality.
Right.
You know.
And this is a real point we want people to think about and stress to them, is that you have to really question the motives of some of these people who on the surface might be nationalistic or patriotic on the surface. You have to really question, what is it they really want to accomplish? What is behind that issue, just that issue alone? We'll take a break now, but when we come back, we're going to talk more a little more about that, and we'll also talk about the plan out of the crisis, what Golden Dawn's position is on that.
Away, promise the gift, this is a good day, I promise the
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Golden Dawn America's radio podcast. I'm George, and with me again is Ed. And what we're going to do now is talk about a little bit about the future, a little bit about how Golden Dawn intends to get out of this crisis. Now, you know, of course, we in the previous section, we told you about how everything ended up to this point, how the crisis was started and how bad it's gotten. And, you know, now let's talk a little bit about what it's going to take to get out of this. Now, Golden Dawn has several positions on this, but I'm going to go through four major ones, okay? Now, the first one is the auditing of the public debt in Greece, okay? Now, what that means is that Golden Dawn wants to look at all the loans that have been given, all the kickbacks, all the records we have financial of different municipalities in Greece and politicians about what they did with the money, where did the money go, and so on and so forth. Okay, now, Golden Dawn intends to form a special audit team. Okay, they're going to go in, they're going to look at all the books, every file, every public organization, everything. This has never been done before in Greece. We want to see who received money under the table, okay, in the last decades. And this is going to reveal to us which part of this debt that we supposedly owe is illegal and which part might be legitimate. And believe me when I tell you this, a lot of it is going to be illegitimate, okay? Now, number two, a total cleaning of the system of corruption, okay? Now, there was a university in northern Greece, the Macedonian University of Thessaloniki, which did a report, okay? And they have estimated that the corruption costs in Greece amount annually to the sum of 14 billion, that's billion with a B, a year. Okay? 14 billion euros a year.
Wow.
In corruption. Now, the only way to deal with this corruption is to lift the immunity of all the members of parliament. Now, they've tried to do that to Golden Dawn to you know, obviously, they went through with the lifting Golden Dawn members' immunity in order to cook up a fake, case against them, against our parliamentary members and members of our party in general. But this immunity has not been lifted from any other political party, ever, ever. Now, we want that to change. We want all the political parties and all members of parliament to have their immunity lifted, because nobody should be immune from the law in terms of corruption. Nobody.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Okay? Now, we're going to have a specific control group, okay, that's going to be responsible for finding those who squandered the public funds in all the ministries, any kind of government agency, any other institution. Not only that, TV channels, newspapers, construction companies that receive kickbacks for the construction contracts over all these years of PASOK and New Democracy, okay? Okay, also the Lagarde list, you know, in London, all these, you know, everything like this is going to be found out, and these people are going to go directly to prison. and their property completely seized, gone, becomes property of the state, the state that Golden Dawn controls. Becomes it's just appropriated immediately. Goodbye. That's it. Okay, number three. Disengagement from the debt. Okay? Now, from the period of 2012 to 2014, the private banks have received more than 50 billion euros for their recapitalization. Now, these debts, they don't concern the Greek people. And those responsible for them are private banks. So it's not acceptable for the people to pay for that.
Yeah, who pays for their debts?
Right. Exactly. Now, this is something that, you know, you see it with the Euro group, you know, and it's been done before in Spain where the people have, you know, made some issues with this, and it can be done in Greece as well. Okay? Now, number four. And this is quite a point of contention, I would say, among some people that have been asking us about this. And this is the claiming of the occupation loan that dates back to the German occupation in World War II. Okay? Now, let me be clear about this. Golden Dawn wants to reclaim the repayment of an occupation loan that was under the German army was received by the German army received a loan back then from the Bank of Greece, okay? Actually, during the before the German occupation ended, they had actually started paying this loan back, okay? And after that, the payment stopped after the end of the war. And the debt was acknowledged by the German state. It was acknowledged as money that the German government owed Greece.
Under international law, they
under
were...
Under international law.
The way it worked was that they take a loan to occupy the country, but then they have to pay it back. And Hitler was paying the loan back before the war ended. So it's not like... It's something they just pulled out. It's not like people were comparing it to Holocaust reparations, but it's nothing like that.
Exactly.
Because this is actually like a real thing that right. Hitler was paying back, and that's it. It's a real
now,
debt.
Here's the thing. Some people were commenting and messaging us and saying, well, you know, it's not a good idea to you know, the Golden Dawn should do that because, you know, it's like making German people feel guilty for what happened during World War II, and it's not fair, you know, to get them to pay for that, and, you know, it's happened so long ago and this kind of thing. But like you said, this is not anything related to, like, what Israel does with Germany, which is, like, every couple of years they come around and they ask for more money, or they ask for a submarine, or they ask for this or that, which is like a constant bleeding of the German people. What Golden Dawn is saying is that Germany, if Germany says that Greece should, you know, honor its debts to the Eurozone and all this kind of stuff, then Germany should honor its debts to the countries that it took responsibility for as a government of occupying. And keep in mind, this is the German government right now that acknowledges that they have these debts. The thing is, the Germans feel that if they don't pay it to the Greeks, unlike the Jews, that nothing's going to happen. What are the Greeks going to do about it?
Exactly.
And that's why the Germans don't pay it. And there's also
once again, Hitler was paying it back. He recognized the loan and was paying it back like he did with other countries. The problem was, after the war, Greece was expected to write off their debt so that the German economy could rebuild.
Right.
That's what happened. And because the Germans, the Greeks didn't really have a say with that, Golden Dawn believes that this is an illegitimate write-off and that, you know, it's like a tit for tat, you know? If we're going to forgive your loan because you want to rebuild your economy, then you should be willing to do the reverse. That's
right.
The whole thing. And on top of that, well, the debt that you got was actually legitimate, and you were paying it back already, you know?
the thing was that after World War II, the German government acknowledged all of these atrocities that they supposedly had done everywhere during the war, even ones they didn't do, okay? Mm-hmm. For example, they admitted starting the whole war and, you know, the things with... It was a whole long and complicated thing that we can't get into now, but what I will say is that they basically prioritized who they should pay back and who they don't need to pay back. They acknowledged everybody. Like, even, for example, Italy has a similar case against Germany right now with that. But they figured the same thing. Oh, we don't need to pay those Italians. Who cares? You know, what are they going to do? Whereas with the Jews, with the Israel and all that, well, there is something the Jews can do. They can get America to come and make a beef with Germany over it, and then Germany is going to pull out their wallet. Okay?
Well, so, you know, even France, George, France recently... started paying Jews, so like some few thousand Jews started claiming that a French train company took them to a concentration camp, and there's no proof they were even there, but any Jew that says that gets free money from the French government. So what's the big deal with paying back a loan that you took is on paper is co-signed, and you were paying back, and then was just magically not accepted anymore after the war.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, yeah, their argument, George, is that this was done under Hitler, not the current government, but then why can't Greeks make that argument? This was done under Jews, like Papandreou, not our current, well, it's being worse than now, but under Golden Dawn, it wouldn't be the same government, you know? So, it's the same argument.
Yeah, well, it's more accurate to say that this whole thing, even if you left out the scandals with Siemens and all these German companies that were giving kickbacks to Greek politicians for German contracts and everything else, the money from the occupation loan, it amounts to, in today's money, to over 510 billion euros, okay? So what Greece is saying, what Golden Dawn is saying, is, look, okay, whatever we owe you, supposedly, you can offset it and deduct that, you know, with the money that, you know, you owe from the occupation loan. So basically what Greece is saying is, it's not like we're trying to, the government under Golden Dawn would say, okay, we want you to keep paying us and everything. We just want out of the whole process. It's done. It's over with. It was illegitimate then, and it's illegitimate now. Mm-hmm. So that's it. It's pretty simple, actually, when you really get down to it. And the only way we can, you know, regain a true national leadership is to stand up for the rights of the Greek people, which nobody's done before, because all these other governments have been rolling over to anything that the EU wants and whatnot, and it's got to stop.
Well, you want to see little ways in which being in the European Union retards the economy. Russia is Greece's number one trade partner, and now the European Union is forcing Greece to stop trading with Russia. They have to sanction them. How does that make sense for a struggling economy? They're going to lose untold billions. There's already farmers and stuff that require on exporting to Russia that are pretty much going bankrupt now because of some stupid sanctions over something that has nothing to do with Greece because Brussels mandates it. I mean, that goes to show you something. Being in the European Union does nothing for them. They can't stay in it. And I what's funny, George? I thought Syriza, didn't Syriza have that on their platform? That they were going to leave the European Union?
No. Some of them were saying, like, some of their more extreme factions were saying little things like that or hinting towards it. But they were saying, oh, we want to stay in the Eurozone, but at the same time, we're going to rip up the memorandum. That was the purpose.
Well, they did rip up the memorandum. Now it's just the institutions, you know.
Right, institutional
partners. They changed the title. Yeah.
Right.
So, there you go.
Now, I got to say, now, one thing which we didn't touch on, which I got to say, is the reaction of the Greek people in light of all this flip-flopping and acrobatics. The best way I could describe it is that there's still a certain portion of Greeks Greeks are notorious for this, where they have a kind of an ego, you know, and they voted for a party, and they don't want to admit they're wrong as of yet. They're a little nervous, but some of these more diehard series of people, and I don't mean like the diehard leftist one, like the really pure leftist ones. I mean like the more average, let's say, middle of the road ones. They have this attitude like, oh, okay, so they changed the name of everything. You know, it's not. It's going to be all right. You know, let's wait and see. Because they still have that kind of nagging thing of like they don't want to admit that they got robbed, basically, that they got duped. You understand? You know, nobody wants to admit that they got, you know, that they got had, you know, and somebody robbed them like that. It's a little bit embarrassing, I guess you could say, for a lot of people. Not everyone, though, because some of the more extreme leftist factions. So for now, here's where we're at right now. And this is probably within the last week or so. Now, today is March 4th, and right now, it's at the point where Sirius is backed off of pretty much everything. There's a huge chasm within Sirius right now, where some of its members and some of its leading members, like, for example, there's one very famous Greek leftist figure named Manolis Glezos. Glezos was the one who was, the story goes, as the leftists claim, that Glezos, when he was a teenager during the Nazi occupation of Greece, snuck through an entire German armory at the top of Athens in the Acropolis, he snuck past all the Germans. I guess they must have been sleeping or something, or playing cards or smoking cigarettes, I don't know. And he went up on the top of the Acropolis, and he tore down the Nazi flag and put up a Greek one without ever getting caught. And he had accomplices, too. He had like two other guys that went with him. He's been a historical figure, absolute legend in the leftist circle. He's like the closest thing Greece has to a living Che Guevara type or something like this, even though Che Guevara is a totally different story compared to this guy. Mm-hmm. But so he went on TV, and he also wrote an article saying, apologizing to the Greek people that he was contributing to the illusion of Syriza. Okay. He said, basically, I was wrong, and you know, I'm really sorry that I contributed to this illusion and that Syriza hasn't done anything that they said they were going to do. And as a result, one of Syriza's ministers said that Glezos, who's 90, I think he's 94 years old now, said that he was misinformed. So he basically called the leftist legend an idiot, you know, a babbling old fool that, I mean, he didn't say that, but that's basically what he's implying. The guy's misinformed. Then there was a second one, a famous composer, Mikis Theodorakis, who's known for like Zorba the Greek and all these famous songs that everybody knows. Another leftist, anti-junta, you know, anti, you know, right-wing type of figure. And he went on the television and said things against Syriza. And in a panic, Alexis Tsipras, the prime minister, went to Theodorakis' house and tried to talk with him and say, look, you know, I'm just doing something, I'm playing a game with them. I'm playing a game with the EU, Mikis. I'm not really, you know, when you play cards, you have to, you know, not show your whole hand. And I watched this interview. It was just pathetic. Like, it was just public, a public relations disaster for Syriza. So now you have their leftist, icons that are turning against them. Now the Greek media is also, it went from being like making how, oh, look, he's not wearing a tie. Oh, look, he's so nice and dashing. Oh, look, the finance minister rides a motorcycle and plays video games. Now it's like, oh, man, they're not doing anything. Now they're switching again. Now it's probably, my guess is, they're going to start pushing Topotami, the river, which is the media's darling because it's paid for by all the Greek media bosses. This party is actually created by the Greek media. It's actually, there's journalists that make up the party. So this is something entirely different. That's probably the next step. Now, in light of that, at the end of this month, Nikos Mihaloyakos, our leader, is going to be released. He is going to be put on house arrest. Christos Papas is going to be released, and he's not going to be on house arrest because they have, I guess, they have so little or not even the pretense of any kind of charge, they can't even put him on the house arrest. Yanis Lagos is also going to be released, and I believe they're going to try to put him on house arrest, but it hasn't been finalized yet or something like this. So basically, these men have done a full 18 months as by law, and not a single court case or charges have been filed. I mean, I shouldn't say filed, but they haven't really put it to trial yet. They have nothing. And believe me, if they had something, they would have done it by now. So now the talk is, are they going to televise this trial? Are they going to try to have a secret trial? Golden Dawn is pushing for, you know, an open televised trial so all the Greek people can see the sham that this whole thing is, you know. So,
well, would you say that it's possible for them to ever have to go back in? Could, if they don't try them, could they charge them again and hold them for another 18 months? Is that legal?
No, they can only hold them legally. The way it works is that if they've been charged with a series of crimes that has not went to trial yet, for those crimes, they can only hold them for 18 months. They can't, at least until that trial gets completed, they can't hit them with more charges and then put them in for another 18 months. Okay? If that trial was completed and then they were sentenced or everything was thrown out and then, I mean, yeah, theoretically they could try to put them in for another 18, but they have to have something different than the previous trial, which is hard because they've invented everything, you know? I mean, what else could you invent? They invented everything from murder to money laundering, loan sharking, you know.
Protection rackets.
Who knows? Stepping on a cat's tail, you know. Anything, they came up with anything they could imagine in that indictment. So there's really not much else they could come up with, you know. They'd have to invent new forms of crime just to put it in a court document, you know.
Well, so, I think the fact that they're being released is pretty much proof of their innocence to the public. That's probably why they're keeping it so quiet. They don't want him, they don't want to put them on trial because it'll put them back in the headlines, and chances are all the evidence is on their side, too.
They're promising to put them on trial in April.
Well, they're going to have to do it soon. They have to release them by the 27th. So this is a very interesting situation.
Yeah, basically what happens in Greece right now, ladies and gentlemen, is I don't know how to say this. This is an unprecedented type of thing that will affect the future of nationalism all over Europe. It sets a precedent for what kind of things you're going to see happen in all of Europe after this. Because if they try this in another European country, and it fails again, or, you know, it's going to be a lot more difficult for the system to justify this type of thing after this.
Well, I think that if this was happening in Bangladesh or, you know, Afghanistan, the European Union would be all over it. But since it's happening in Greece and the target is a so-called neo-Nazi party or a nationalist party that refuses to give in to the system, suddenly it's all in the name of democracy and human rights. You know, that goes to show you think you can negotiate with these people. You can't negotiate with Zionists, you can't negotiate with Eurocrats, and you can't negotiate with the system. You gotta hold steadfast and defy everything they throw at you, because they will put you in prison for no reason and do everything they can to sabotage you. So I think that this issue with Golden Dawn is very important, you know? This is
You know, Artemis Mathaopoulos, who you mentioned earlier, when I was talking to him on Skype a while ago, and he had told me that, you know, he's working day and night. They have him traveling, you know, from town to town in Greece, you know, going to the different Golden Dawn offices, meeting with different people. And he once said that, you know, one of the reporters asked him, he said, is this the, you know, when the trial was first happening, he said, is this the end of Golden Dawn? Is this the end, you know, are you seeing this as the end of Golden Dawn? And he goes, no, he goes, this isn't the end of Golden Dawn. This is the beginning of their end, mm-hmm. he said. And that's very true, because it's even reflected in the things they're saying. Like, for example, like what Chomsky had said, which was, yeah, they now that the system, the last line of defense of capitalism, which is Syriza, has failed and disillusioned people, this is the beginning of the end. The only question is, how long will it take for this to unravel? Okay? That's the only real question. It's not a question of if it will unravel. It's a question of when.
And people, additionally, they can't really sell Enel anymore because they've pretty much, they're being marred by the bad publicity series of
right.
garnering.
Well, that's actually, I had a theory about that, because a lot of people were asking, why didn't Syriza go with Enel for the coalition? Because remember, Enel had more votes than independent Greeks.
No, you mean KKE?
No, not KKE. I'm sorry, Potami.
Oh, Potami. Right, that.
Potami had more votes than independent Greeks, Enel. Now, people were wondering, well, okay, well, Potami is not a, it's not a right-wing party. So in theory, it would have been better for them to go with Potami, because Potami was, let's say, much more palatable for leftists, because Potami did say some leftist things. Now, they weren't coming out as a full-on anti-austerity party, but Potami was basically like saying, "Oh, we're not right, we're not left. We will." They basically said they're going to announce their positions after they get elected. You know, okay. Really, seriously, there's actually parties in Greece that say, "We're going to tell you what our political platform is after you vote for us. Then we're going to announce what we're going to do." It's like a what's in the box type of thing, you know?
Exciting. So,
yeah. It's like a mystery box, you know?
There
you open
go.
It up and see what's in the, you know, it's like the Price is Right, you know, with that. But, so, I think, and I know, this is just speculation, but I think that they intended to burn Enel, Independent Greeks, with Syriza in case that happened, because they needed another safety valve, because, you know, these Zionists, they're always thinking ahead. They're always thinking, you know, three moves ahead. You know, they're playing
yeah.
chess. You know, yeah. you know, you might not be playing chess, but believe me, they are. You know.
Oh yeah.
So, that's it. So I think they're going to start, and that's probably the most likely scenario next.
Yeah, but I don't think so, because they have such limited appeal. I mean, people, even average people, see right through that Potami group, man. They're really transparent about
being
lying scumbags.
Well, now, yeah, see, here's the issue, is that every time they do this, that they burn a party and then try to prop up another one in its place, they lose more and more people. Like, they never get the majority that they would have with Syriza again, you know? And, yeah, they will get some people, but it's not going to work like before. So, yeah.
How long do you give this series a government?
Oh, I would say under a year, and that's being generous, you know.
Under a year, huh?
Under a year, yeah.
Well, I guess we have to wait for the media-created fervor to come down a little bit, because people are still under the impression that they've actually won something. So
yeah, but like I said, in the last week, it's starting to change already. the media is starting to turn against them. That's why I'm saying about Bothami, because they have to tell, they have to veer them somewhere else after that, and it ain't going to be Golden Dawn.
Well, so, I mean, you know, when it comes to that party, the River of Bothami, journalists are liars. How about a journalist that runs as a politician? I mean, come on now. Who's gonna fall for that one? A lying journalist becomes a politician. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I don't even think they're gonna even try with them. They might try to prop up the other parties again, like New Democracy, but that might be a lost cause at this point.
Yeah, they're already kind of burnt, those ones.
I mean, it's pretty much gonna be Golden Dawn, either second or first the next election. That's what I would say. And to avoid a Golden Dawn government, you're going to see Syriza and New Democracy forming a coalition. You watch. You watch.
I love to see that. Well, I guess by then people won't be so shocked anymore about that, you know.
Nah, it'll just look like the PASOK replacement, only with more votes, you know.
Yeah, it's like PASOK number two. That's basically what it is. You know, the real problem with it is, though, is that the difference with Syriza and PASOK is that PASOK came at a time when there was money to flow into the country to bribe all the, to build this army of voters, whereas now Syriza doesn't have that advantage. So it's not the same thing.
You know? And another thing that's interesting is that no one voted for their social platform. Everyone voted on them under the impression that they were anti-capitalist and they were going to stop the memorandum. But no one voted for them because they're going to bring more Negroes into Greece or because they're going to have more gay pride parades. But,
yeah,
you see, they're going to keep that promise because that's part of the Jewish agenda in Greece to support infantile sexuality. Like in other parts of Europe, they have they're showing kids porn in Denmark and stuff. You know, they're going to start imposing that cultural Marxist social policy.
Yeah, but you know what?
No,
again,
wants.
That's another unfortunate thing. And I had always said this years ago. I said, if the Greek economy had kept going the way it was under PASOK for longer, it would have been easier for the powers that be to implement these types of changes. You know, promoting the cultural Marxist slant and the pro-homosexuality type of slant and all of these kind of things. And that's, and I believe you said this in the past, you said that like in the communist era, the Stalinist part of communism, they used to say that homosexuality is something for bourgeoisie.
Right.
It's a problem for rich people. It's something that people who aren't workers and common people, a sickness that's afflicted by them. So basically what you notice all over the world is in poor countries, which is what Greece is becoming, things like feminism and homosexuality tend to not do that well. Like,
right.
For example, find me a poor country where people are starving anywhere in the world where feminism is a biggest widespread thing. Where?
That's a first world problem, like transphobia.
Right, exactly.
Show me a third world country where they complain about transphobia.
Exactly. And the thing is that Greece is not even close anymore now to a first world or Western European standard of living anymore for most of the people. It's not. It is a banana republic right now under this current government, and it will remain like that with any government except for Golden Dawn. There's just no way. Golden Dawn is the only way out of this.
You want to see the reverse of that. You're starting to see that more in Poland right now, where there's a lot of, ever since they joined the European Union, they're undergoing a huge credit bubble, just like Greece did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
They're doing okay. There's more jobs and stuff, and on top of that, all the young working class men in their country, millions of them, are leaving to go to other places in Europe. So in Poland right now, there's a lot of that queer stuff for that there's a lot more immigration there from non-white countries. There's a lot of feminism. Polish women are no longer family oriented. The new generation is starting to become more career oriented and stuff. And the thing is that when you have when there's money, you could subsidize these things, you know? You can't have feminism in a country that is struggling because there's no jobs for women. There's no jobs for men or women, but especially not for women, you know? And there's no infrastructure for people to develop these compulsions and these anti-natural homosexual feelings. There's no, they don't have enough idle time to start thinking, can I have sex with this person's ear? Can I have sex with their nose?
The reason that these things were so successful, for instance, in the United States was because not only did the United States, of course, have this, Jewish-dominated media and a very good propaganda mechanism, it also had years of relative post-World War II economic prosperity.
Yeah, they weren't touched by the war.
Right. So they had, you know, after World War II, you had the mass availability of the automobile, for example. Like, I remember that reading about, you know, history of the baby boomer generation in the United States and how, like, every single, you know, young person, you know, got their driver's license at, not, I shouldn't say every single, but a huge amount got their driver's license at 16, had a car by 18 or 19. They drive around, you know, the great American roadway, freedom and money from the parents and everything. And then they went to university. They got all these ideas. And they didn't really feel the sting of these ideas until they were already middle-aged and the younger generation started to feel the effects of, rampant drug use and multiculturalism and immigration and things like this, you know. So, even during that period, it still hadn't collapsed to the point like it has in Greece yet, you know. So they've managed to keep this running, and they've had a lot more time to indoctrinate people, whereas in Greece, they're trying to do this at like the last, it's like they're trying to rush everything at the last moment before this collapses even more, you know.
Yeah, the whole money thing is fight or flight. If you have money and suddenly, you know, your kid's school is full of Arabs and blacks and they're attacking your kid, if you have money, you can pull them out of the school and put them in private school.
Right.
You know, if you live in a bad neighborhood or it's becoming bad, and we all know what bad means, it means more multicultural, then you can just pick up and leave, move to a nicer neighborhood, as they call it, you know. There's always that option when you have money, but when the money runs out, or you're a working-class person, there's no other way but to fight. If someone's flooding into your school and taking it over, you're going to have to stand your ground and fight them. If someone's coming into your neighborhood, trying to take your neighborhood over, making it in, you know, full of gypsies or whatever, you're going to have to stand up and fight them. If someone's raping your people and you can't leave because it's been your home for 5, 6, 7 generations in a village, and the European Union-led government is dumping these aliens in your neighborhood, you're going to have to protect yourself. You don't have the money to leave. So this is the real dilemma here. It's not that, you know, no majority in human history has ever voted for the liberal system of, liberal perspectives on homosexuality or immigration or anything like that. This is all tolerated because people always have a way to opt out with their money. But if you don't have a way to opt out of it, no one likes that. 99% of people hate that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, here in the tri-state area where I grew up, you know, and until I had moved to Greece, I mean, it was, I was a small child in the late 80s, and I remember from when I was a small child to now, I mean, literally, the amount of whites that left New York City was staggering. I mean, it's like, if that was in a country, like, for example, if that was something that had happened in Greece, it would be like one of the biggest ethnic cleansings that had existed in the whole century, you know? I mean, like, almost 1 million people left. I mean, it's like a city the size of Thessaloniki, you know, like 1 million Europeans just disappearing into somewhere else. Now, of course, they weren't butchered like the Greeks had been by Turks and whatever, but the end result is the same in the sense that, at least in the aspect of that you used to live in this one area for quite a long time, and the people built up all the, you know, the civilization there. You know, if you go around, you know, Brooklyn or parts of Queens or even Manhattan, all these buildings you see and all this architecture and everything was built by Europeans. It wasn't built by It wasn't built by Vietnamese boat people, you know. So, you know, the things that the tourists are taking pictures of and all this iconic things that, you know, everybody talks about here and all the Europeans marvel at, yeah, it wasn't built by, Guatemalan immigrants or blacks. It was built by, Europeans. And a lot of people forget that. A lot of people I talk to in Europe, they don't even know that at one time New York City was like 90-something percent white, you know.
Yeah.
And it's...
But the thing is, you know, even the ones that are left today, it's actually come out that the most segregated schools in America are not in Missouri, they're not in Alabama, they're actually New York,
yeah, that's
Boston,
right.
All these urban, multicultural, melting pot success stories have the most racially segregated schools.
And neighborhoods, too, traditionally.
And neighborhoods as well. I mean, neighborhoods here change completely within a few blocks from each other, but once you cross that line, it's a certain ethnic group lives in that area. And the government, whenever the government tries to, or even private home sellers and stuff try and change that, the people just pick up and leave.
Right.
I mean, this is human nature. I mean, even leftists and liberals that live in progressive places like California, you know, once their community becomes full of Mexicans, they pick up and leave and go to a whiter place.
Right.
So I mean, no one really believes in this garbage. You have to bribe people or give them a way to opt out in order to pull this off. And you're not going to do that in Greece. You're not going to do that in Southern Europe. And some parts of Southern Europe that aren't doing that bad, maybe. You know, like in Italy, there's a lot of immigration now. Italy, believe it or not, has some of the most immigrants per capita in all of Europe from Africa. And this is because of Dublin II, of course. You know, this is another problem that we need to talk about. Also, we should have talked about is that countries like Sweden and Holland and Germany, to a lesser extent, they have these really lax asylum seeker policies where if you come in through Italy and then go to Holland, they'll sometimes give you citizenship no matter who you are, you know?
Right.
Like, if you go to Holland and you're like a Somalian, and you go to Holland or Sweden, you say, oh, you know, in my country, I'm actually a faggot. And if I go back to my country, they're going to kill me. The Dutch government and the Swedish government will give you citizenship just for that.
Right, that's right.
You know, if you say, oh, I come from an Islamic country, and if they know I'm a faggot, then they're going to kill me. They have, like, laws, immigration laws, dedicated to giving these people citizenship, even if they're lying. You know, a lot of people during the Geert Wilders age, when Geert Wilders had his party had some significant power in a coalition government, they actually had a record number of asylum seekers. And there was one that was like, I believe it was like 20 or 25 Iranians, and they were claiming to be faggots, and they gave them citizenship just because of that. You know, and so this is a problem too. You got to get these countries to stop giving these invaders goodies, stop giving them incentives to enter Europe, because you know what? They come into Europe, they go to your countries like Sweden, Germany, and Holland. You deport them, and where do you deport them to? You deport them to Greece. You deport them to Italy. You deport them to
Spain. Right.
That's completely unfair. Why not deport them back to their own country?
Yeah, well, that's the Dublin II law that they signed.
Yeah, but it's absolutely absurd, because then they deport them to Southern Europe, and then when the Southern Europeans can't afford to stack, you know, you can only stack so many of these black people on top of each other before you can't stack anymore, you know?
And, yeah, sure.
And when that happens, the European Union goes to Southern Europe, and, you know, they go to Greece, and they say, oh, What are you doing to these precious asylum seekers? Why don't they have more air conditioning and better food and stuff? But they never even once asked that about the white people that live there, who are actually going without heating or going without food.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where this Dublin II directive, it's not just a matter of, sending them back to Greece and trying to make the Greeks feel guilty for how they treat the immigrants and all this kind of stuff. It's actually put in place also to keep the, the economic engine countries like Germany running more smoothly, because it gives them the option of deporting immigrants that are more unruly and only keeping immigrants that are like, let's say, semi-skilled immigrants. And I'm not talking about, of course, the Turks and stuff that are born in the country that they can't get rid of, but, you know, it's a way for them to filter out some of the worst of the refuse of the, third world and keep things somewhat orderly in those countries so they don't have a backlash and they don't have another Golden Dawn on their hands or something like that. But that's just buying them time. You know, eventually these people are going to, Sweden and these countries that are paying for iPads and houses and bicycles and God knows what else they're giving them, eventually they're going to run out of money too. I mean, it's only a matter of time. I mean, they're producing some things. They have a high tax rate. They have, money flowing through the country, unlike in Greece. But that's, at some point, that's going to end. And when that ends, it's going to be the same thing that happened in Greece, and maybe even worse in some cases, because, like I said, some of those people don't have antibodies to deal with these kind of things, like some of the Greeks have had for so long dealing with this kind of thing, and that's going to be a really big turning point in Europe.
I think people that talk about the economic problems that are happening in places like Greece or Ireland or Spain or whatever, and they make sure to say that it's because it's the people's fault, right? But you can only think back to the 1920s and 30s in Germany, that their economy was even worse. And, I mean, you're going to just blame the people for that?
Yeah, they were actually trying to buy bread with a wheelbarrow full of money.
Right. It's not the people's fault. It's really the way the system works, which is meant to keep everyone's hand in everyone else's pocket.
Yeah, I mean, like, what I ask is how come they're not, all these immigrants that are coming from these poor, destroyed countries in the Middle East and Africa, how come they're not saying, oh, they're poor because it's their fault,
Oh. You
know? How come it's not their fault that they're poor? Right, okay, it only applies to white Southern Europeans or Eastern Europeans that are, it's only their fault. When they're poor, it's their fault. But when it's African who's poor, it's not his fault,
I'd like to see what kind of economic state Israel would be in without all the free money that they get from Europe and America.
Yeah.
That basket case of a dinky country. Well, what would happen then? Yeah.
Well, it's certainly food for thought. I mean, you're going to see a lot of stuff happening in the next decade. And, Golden Dawn is going to be standing up first in terms of that right now, and we hope that this is going to be echoed in other European countries, and I'm sure slowly it will be, and all the nationalists out there, I hope that you keep up the fight and you continue to do what you can to facilitate this, because this is going to be everybody's in this together right now. This isn't the world it once was back in, in the 1930s or 1940s, when European countries were much less connected to one another. Now, whether we like it or not, the world is a much smaller place now, and in order for us to survive as a people, in order for Greeks to survive, and Italians, and Spanish, and Germans, and Swedes, and everything like this, they have to work together on some level for the benefit of all of them. And
Yep.
With that, I'd like to, I guess we'll wrap it up for tonight, and I'd like to thank you for being with us again tonight, and Ed, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
Nope, that's about it.
Okay, well, good night, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Have a